everyone, and welcome to another edition of Troy Noons is an Absolute Podcast. I'm your host, as always, John Casillo, and with me today is Dan Lyon.
Hello, everyone. Happy Indiana till. Well, I guess they can kind of solve the zone, but they also turn the ball over a lot. They still can't beat Syracuse basketball, which is nice.
Never so that again. Good. That was the price we paid for 87.
Yes. Or the price they paid, I guess.
Yeah, we'll lose this game and no other game ever.
And again, like, they probably got the better of the trade, but, you know, we might as well keep benefiting from whatever deal with the devil that Bobby Knight signed, you know, 30-something years ago.
I would agree there. Happy Mets week.
Happy Steve Cohen doing the things that we expected him to do, but he hadn't really done yet, except for the Lindor trade. Yeah, wow. Like, to dive in slightly into Mets talk for a bit here. Certainly, when I saw the Scherzer stuff, considering all of the buzz around Scherzer vis-a-vis the Mets was that he absolutely didn't want to play for them and, like, specifically outlined them as, like, a team that he would enforce his new trade for and et cetera, I guess $43 million a year speaks. Who knew?
I'm pretty sure it could speak to anyone.
I would play for the Mets for $43 million a year.
I think anyone would. It's pretty great. We'll leave it at that. I think you'll hear plenty more Mets talk throughout the offseason and especially, you know, early next year as the team suddenly becomes a legitimate player in baseball and a competitor for the World Series on potentially an annual basis, which I would very much love to see after many decades of suffering.
That would be great. I would totally take it.
Indeed. Speaking of suffering, Syracuse football decided to lose the final three games in resounding fashion, as we probably predicted would happen. They finished 5-7. It's rough because obviously we lost three straight games by, a single possession. So not great if any of those go the other way. SU finished 6-6, and we're having a different conversation here. At the same time, we had two games decided very late, and if we lose both of those games, we're 3-8, and 3-9. Sorry, and everyone's wondering why Dino wasn't fired. So keep everything in perspective there. Dino went and made three staffing changes immediately following the season on Sunday. Vince Reynolds out as D-line coach, Reno Ferry out as tight ends coach, and Sterling Gilbert, the most important one there, out as offensive coordinator after 2 years of a pretty decrepit attack overall on his end. Dan, I think we all would have felt better if the order of this had been Gilbert first and then the other two. At the same time, I'm really not sure why Reynolds was fired other than somebody needed to go on the defensive side, I guess.
Yeah, the Reynolds thing is kind of interesting. Not to, you know, I think the Gilbert thing is the most important. It's the OC. It's an OC who's been largely ineffective the last 2 years. And also an OC who doesn't really make sense moving forward if we're going to kind of go into Garrett Schrader world for the foreseeable future, or even just flirt with Garrett Schrader world while developing Justin Lampson, who probably isn't as run heavy as Schrader, but possesses some of the same skills and same frame. Jacoby Morgan's probably a little more pocket based, but like if we're you know, I think for the foreseeable future, the Babers' tenure hinges on, in all likelihood, Schrader being like taking a big step forward next year, which we can't rule out. Like, he was certainly really effective early on when teams didn't really know how to prepare for it. Obviously, that waned significantly down the stretch. But obviously, Schrader is a run-heavy quarterback. The offense, at its best, kind of resembled something like an option attack without, like, always being, you know, obviously there was read option involved. But just in terms of, like, the style and the fact that you had to constantly pay attention to two run-heavy players, it kind of resembled that in terms of how the offense, like, realistically worked. So it didn't really make any sense to keep Gilbert, who was coming from a much different system than that. In my opinion, like, you kind of need to go find someone who's going to be able to work with the talent that we have. And trying to shoehorn Schrader into a different system doesn't make any sense. Trying to, you know, pretend like Gilbert's going to all of a sudden, you know, start running really advanced spread option concepts doesn't make a lot of sense. So let's go, like, get someone who can really make this work as a pairing and with Babers. So hopefully that's what we'll see. Obviously there's a couple, like, some stuff has been floated so far, but it'll be fascinating because I think we've seen Babers kind of go into his well for coaches he's comfortable with. Gilbert was one of those. I am very fascinated to see if the next person comes from a much different background and has like different experiences with those kind of players versus like the Tommy DeVito type players that we were trying to build around earlier.
Yeah, I mean, that's the tough part here is like, do you go get someone that has a lot of experience with a dual threat quarterback or I think in our case here, a running quarterback? Do you bring in someone who's more of a quarterback guru who can at least help Schrader come along better as a passer? Because then realistically, he has to run less and he's a more effective player overall, and it makes it easier to run the ball with Sean Tucker and others out of the backfield. I think the answer that most people seem to be gravitating toward is Kent State's Andrew Sauter, formerly of the Dino tree back when they were at Bowling Green. Sauter did not join with most of the rest of the Falcons crew when Babers came on in 2016. He's now the OC at Kent State under Sean Lewis, who did come along. I think most people have him on the list because there's some continuity. There's, you know, some hope that he brings kind of the Lewis magic that I think was a big part of the first couple seasons of Babers' tenure at Syracuse and brings that along with him. I know for me, I mean, one name that I tossed out there was, you know, Matt Mummy, son of Hal Mummy, offensive coordinator and QB coach at Nevada. I'd be interested in seeing what that looked like because, you know, Western Kentucky has a couple guys on staff who have quarterback experience with guys who are dual threats, guys who are traditional pocket passers. I don't think we want to make Trader a pocket passer, to your point, but wouldn't be the worst idea to bring in someone who just at least has experience developing passers. You know, Anthony Tucker over at Utah State's another name that I've kind of thrown out there, as well as Kevin Johns over at Memphis. Though I do think that Johns is he has enough experience at this point leading Memphis that I think that he's likely to head somewhere bigger than SU, and with so many jobs open, it would seem likely that his name gets called.
Yeah, I thought you put together a pretty strong list. Sauter made so much sense, and I know I immediately am like, he's like the one guy where it is a Babers person, but his experience is both under Sean Lewis, who obviously helmed many of the better Babers offenses, but also the fact that Kent State's offense looks closer to what we expected from Babers offenses from the Bowling Green days. Like Dustin Crum, who's their extremely efficient, effective quarterback, is a bigger thrower than Schrader, threw for, you know, 2,800 yards this year, 15 touchdowns, only 4 interceptions. But he also was a pretty prolific runner. He ran for 565 yards, third on the team. He ran for 11 touchdowns. I don't think he's quite a Schrader-style player, but Sauter clearly has experience kind of developing an offense where you have a quarterback who's a major running threat. And then they also had a 1,000-yard rusher in Marquez Tooper. They had a 700-yard rusher in Xavier Williams. It just seems like the kind of profile of an offense that's super well-balanced and can do a lot of damage through both facets that we want to kind of model ourselves around with Sean Tucker and Schrader in the backfield. So he has the benefit of being a Babers guy, and it wouldn't shock me at all if he's the guy, but also I think his offenses under Lewis are far closer to what we also want, just removed from the fact that he has that Babers experience too. So if he's like the guy, you know, I think I'd be very comfortable with that. It makes a lot more sense than Gilbert did, to be honest. I think he's probably the clubhouse favorite. But I like some of the names. Kevin Johns has obviously been around for a while. Memphis's offenses have been really, really dynamic. Western Kentucky was really good this year, so I appreciate seeing those guys, though. I think they're, you know, that's much more of a like a cultural like splash trying to really change stuff. But it'll be fascinating. I mean, Matt Mummy would be the same too. Obviously, any Mummy name is under attention. That would be going probably closer to the spread routes. Although, as you noted, Carson Strong is like one of the best quarterbacks in college football, a potential first round pick. So he could certainly probably elevate the game. But I do think we need to kind of tailor things to Schrader's strengths, and I also think like Babers kind of needs to do that too. Like, it's really nice to think about developing a quarterback over years and whatnot, but he needs to win 6 games next year. Like, really, we need to win 6 games next year, which is going to be really tough with a schedule that is not really lined up well for it.
Yeah, I was going to weigh in on that at some point on the site, but it's a pretty tough season. I don't necessarily see anything. Like, it's not like I couldn't see 6 wins, but I think 3 wins is a more realistic benchmark for next year. And really, if it's 3 wins, then he's out. And if there's a doubt that Dino can win 6 next year, then you might as well pay up and move on this offseason. I think that Dino understands how tough the schedule is next year. with both Purdue and Notre Dame on as P5 opponents. A pretty, you know, challenging schedule, really, home and away. Not the ideal situation you're looking for if you're Syracuse. And I think that really, like, you do need to win six games next year, and that largely means getting this OC hire right immediately out the gate, but without any time for, like, ramp up. So hopefully we see, you know, a hire made soon. It'd be great to make an impact on the recruiting trail, given how few commits we have so far this year, which is 10. We keep losing players via transfer portal. I know everyone's losing players, but we're losing more than most. I forgot which site is tracking that, but right now, I know we have the most transfers. Oklahoma could end up taking that title soon, potentially, but I know we have the most transfers right now. I think with it's up to 12 since like the beginning of August, with today, Wednesday, names added to that list for the Orange. Luke Benson, who that should surprise no one, given how little tight end positions been used the last 2 years. And then Adrian Cole, cornerback, who played quite a bit this year for Syracuse. And that's actually more surprising and a big bummer, because I do think, especially if Garrett Williams heads out, that's going to be a spot that now is very, very inexperienced in his absence.
The Cole one was definitely more surprising. And also, I thought he played like fairly well and was in a place where like there's a lot of recent examples of defensive backs getting an opportunity to like do really good things. So it was disappointing. Benson, unfortunately, not very disappointing, or not very surprising, definitely disappointing, based on the just like really abandonment of the tight ends over these last couple of years. You know, there were occasional flares, and like every time he got his hands on the ball, it looked like it would be something huge. Last year, he didn't really get the opportunity this year, only caught 5 passes for 22 yards. So yeah, super, super disappointing. And his usage has just waned over the last 2 years. So don't blame him at all for going to try to find an opportunity for his last 2 or 3 years here. Yeah, so it's certainly something that needs to be addressed. Obviously, the recruiting class is also not like this super stocked thing, and we're only a couple weeks away now from the early signing period. So yeah, I mean, I don't think necessarily, I don't think we're in like a great position for like long-term building the program up right now, but the most important thing is to like win games next year. So, ultimately, hopefully we hit the transfer portal pretty hard and try to bring some guys in with the promise of playing time and, you know, figure out how to hodgepodge together a really nice season, because otherwise we're going to be starting from scratch all over it anyway. And then all the like future recruiting classes and stuff, you know, everything kind of hits the reset button as it is.
Yeah, I mean, we're already kind of hitting the reset button right now. And there's like 61 scholarship players on the roster right now. I think that probably ends up going down a little bit more, because we still have to hear about a couple guys who could graduate. Definitely more transfers that could happen in the coming weeks as well. And you can also only add so many guys in a given year. So you have to start getting creative with gray shirts and the like to really fill out, you know, an 85-man roster for next year. Most teams aren't in this sort of situation, just because as many teams have lost as much talent to the portal as we have in the last, you know, 12 months or so. Most teams are actually well over the mark for scholarship limits, you know, after last season, given the, you know, extra eligibility for COVID and all that. So SU's in an unenviable spot, one we can potentially get out of, but it's going to take some effort. Dan, I don't know about you. I'd like to see, you know, a big wide receiver added. I'd love to see a quarterback of some sort added in the transfer portal as well. We're going to have to hit the portal for at least one defensive lineman, depending on what happens with Mikal Jones and the NFL draft. You probably need to look for one there as well, and then maybe another corner, depending on if Garrett Williams leaves or not. But at the same time, I know we definitely have some young corners in this coming class, at least currently committed. At the same time, though, you know, you can't just replace a guy like Garrett Williams or even Adrian Cole, like guaranteed, like out the box with a brand new freshman in 2022.
Yeah, I mean, like, you're not going to have a bunch of Deuce Chestnuts walk in that can play right away and you know, have like all ACC caliber games as a freshman. Like, we've been really, really lucky to find a lot of those guys, but you know, eventually you're going to have like more standard development players coming through. So definitely not the most enviable position. Hopefully hopefully they can keep something cobbled together, and hopefully they're just like, they can't be shy about the transfer portal on the other end of it. Like, they have to be as aggressive as humanly possible, bringing guys in.
We need a kicker because Andre Schmidt's gone now. I forgot.
Yeah, I mean, well, Schmidt is he has another year, doesn't he?
He had another year of eligibility. I don't know if he's going to take it.
That's somewhere else,
or if he's just going to go to the NFL. I don't know if he's necessarily on NFL radars anymore.
I think he probably needs another big year, to be honest. I think Schmidt always had like a limited NFL ceiling because he is so much more accurate inside the 50, and it's hard to sell NFL teams on guys who don't have the leg to hit those long field goals.
Right.
So I think he kind of needs to come back. I mean, and unfortunately for him, he's had all the opportunity in the world to try to hit the long ones. We weren't putting him in a position to hit to do much else after 2018. So, hopefully he comes back. I still think, he can be a reliable kicker if we put him in good opportunities. The problem is the offense is stalling out so far, so often, and Babers, especially early in the year, was playing so conservatively with those decisions that we kind of put Schmidt in a bad position. And also kickers across all levels are super finicky from year to year. So, hopefully he comes back and puts together a nice season after a disappointing 2019 or 2020 stretch here. But, it's tough to know. I mean, I won't really blame him for anything because, even if he doesn't have a great NFL outlook, some guys just don't want to do the college football thing anymore after 4 years. And that's totally understandable.
Yeah, I don't blame him. I mean, based on the Keys football Twitter and Instagram posts, it seemed like he's done. Over the weekend, but we'll see. Things change. Drop the hat sometimes. And before we get to some men's basketball talk, why don't we talk a little bit about beer? What were you drinking over the holiday weekend?
Mostly here in Connecticut. Mostly some Two Roads stuff, which I always like to dip into when I get up here. Had some of their blueberry lemondoza, which was quite nice. Had some of their road jam, which is a raspberry sour they have, which is very good. A couple others. Untappd is driving me crazy with this update they did, where they're trying to push people to do their subscription service. Come on, guys.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then right now, I'm currently drinking a Maku Korean rice beer that I don't know where this. I assume my brother bought it. I don't know how that made its way into my parents' fridge, but that's what I'm drinking. It's very interesting, very very sweet.
On my end, I had a bunch of different things. Had a celebration from Sierra Nevada, as mentioned last week. It's my Thanksgiving go-to. Was down in Anaheim, so went to Modern Times, Leisure Town, their outdoor-centric tap room down there. Had a Stregonona. It was a named after the book that many might be familiar with. It is a grape ale. Very, very interesting. Had a Protosphere. Was an IPA from them. The 5.7% hazy West Coast IPA, so pretty good there. I had Party Vipers, was an Imperial West Coast IPA that they made with Tarantula Hill Brewing up in Thousand Oaks. Had Doomblade, was a black IPA that they brewed earlier this year, and I missed the first time around. Then I had a really, really good from them coffee IPA, probably the best coffee IPA I've ever had. It's called It Comes in Waves from Modern Times. And across the street from the Anaheim spot is actually Unsung Brewing. Had their Siegfrieda Hell's Lager that was really enjoyable. And then over in Orange had Chapman Crafted's Scenic Route West Coast IPA, which is another good selection. So nice variety.
Very nice. Really mixed it up.
But yeah, we alluded to the men's basketball team earlier. We'll talk a little bit about them here before we head out for the week. This team cannot play defense. This team is 6 deep at best, I think, but they did manage to outlast a turnover prone but high scoring Indiana team. I think Indiana looked a lot more impressive on paper as a defensive unit going into this game than Syracuse did, and it was nice to see the Orange be able to outlast them. Overall, strong effort from the Boeheim brothers, but it is kind of harrowing that we needed two overtimes to do this, especially when we were up 16 at halftime. And it was pretty easy for the Hoosiers to get back into this one.
Yeah, I mean, we know the defense is just not very good. That's not a secret. Boeheim said it pretty clearly last night. The numbers back it out. I mean, we saw the Colgate game. I will say that I was impressed with how the team it had, like, in these some of these games, a couple games in Atlantis, their Colgate game, when the game got away from them, they really I don't want to say folded. I don't think they like just collapsed like totally, but they didn't seem to have what it took in those games to really stop the bleeding and get things back right. And obviously in this game, like Indiana closed that 16-point gap in what, the first half of the second half, like the, I guess the third quarter of the game. Maybe it was like the 8-minute mark or so when they tied it. And to Syracuse's credit, they got back to work. They extended the lead back out to like 7. It looked like they're gonna put the game away for a second time. So, you know, I obviously then things got really fuzzy in the last minute, but I do think like this team showed some kind of resiliency that we hadn't seen early in the season. Obviously the defense is going to be a major issue. Hopefully it comes along during the year. Because we do have a ton of young players, not necessarily young, but players that are not super familiar with it, players that aren't really built super well for it, because, you know, for all of the, and anyone listening to this knows, like, for all of the stupid hand-wringing about, like, the zone being, like, lazy defense or whatever, we know the Syracuse zone is so much better when you have really elite athletes, and we do not have those this year.
You're a bit of scrappy
overall. We have some strappy shooters. We have Jesse Edwards, who I think is quietly slash not... I think he's, like, the most important player on the team. I don't even think that's like a hot take at this point. Like, A, he's just really good. He's been the best. He's been the best center we've had since Rakeem Christmas's senior year. He's a legit scoring threat. He could rebound better for sure. He's a huge, huge threat in terms of his shot blocking, which is like the one thing on our defense that's scary for teams. And he was great last night again before he fouled out. And he was about to play like all 40, I think, if, you know, but if he hadn't fouled out, or all 50 or whatever it was, which is crazy to think. So aside from that, like, I think, you know, there's a chance that with more experience, the team gets better defensively to at least we're a point where it's not like one of the 100 worst in college basketball. But we'll see. It's certainly not like a guarantee once we get into ACC play. But also I was impressed from the slightly deep bench guys that haven't been getting a lot of time. I thought Frank, obviously he hit the 4 free throws, but he made some really big defensive plays too. Even when he kind of got beat, he had a couple steals. He had that one recovery in the corner. I thought he played some really heady basketball, and I thought Benny hung in there really well and did the same. Obviously he hasn't quite had the like 5-star jump off the screen performances aside from his like one really nice dunker game. But I tweeted after the Auburn game, like, I think we just need to play Benny a lot. Like, I think he just needs to develop on the fly, because I don't think this team can possibly hit its ceiling without Benny being like a key contributor. And obviously Boeheim does what he does, and he's only going to play the, you know, he said it pretty explicitly last night, guys who aren't helping aren't, you know, going to get the minutes. I think we just need to force some minutes on Benny, because I think, you know, there's only so much you can do when he's not just sitting playing time, and we need to get him comfortable out there. Because that's like the one elite athlete we have. So hopefully his late game play, which was obviously imperfect, but still, you know, he made some big plays down the stretch. Hopefully that instills some more confidence in Boeheim. I'm not holding my breath. But overall, like, I think there were some good things to take away, even if like it was pretty maddening to watch them blow that game basically twice. Because like Indiana might be pretty good. They were 6-0 coming into the game. They didn't have any huge opponents. St. John's, I think, was their premier one before us. They hadn't left the Assembly Hall yet until last night. But I think there's a chance Indiana is like a solid Big Ten team. They have a great player in Jackson Davis. I think it's, you know, too early to say that wasn't like a good win, even if it kind of felt like a shoddy win based on how things played out.
It's a potential bounce back win for now, and I think that counts for something.
Certainly.
Yeah, which is positive. Yeah, I agree with you on Benny. I think that burying him is not a great look for the program, for Jim, in terms of like getting his confidence up and just encouraging him to really like stick with it.
But also recruiting other 5-stars. Like, obviously, I don't think I'm kind of glad we're not doing the like guarantee someone to start and then pull them after 3 minutes like we did for a while there with Christmas and Fab and some other 5-star players. But like, you need to give them the opportunity. Like, you know, I don't know what's happening in practice, but I just think like you're only hurting your own recruiting, because like guys are going to see that. Even if he's clearly not ready to be like one of the center players, like give him 15 to 20 minutes.
Yeah, I mean, he got 19 last night, and most of that was you know, foul related. I think that, yeah, getting to what was essentially a 6-man rotation at best already this season. I mean, Buddy played all 50. Like, it's not a great. It's not that, like, they're clearly good players. Like, Buddy having 27, Jimmy having 26, every one of those points was essential in a 2-point double overtime win. But Like, we got severely out-rebounded when we have big guys, big athletic players on the bench for extended periods of time. Like, Jesse Edwards obviously is coming to his own. That's awesome. But, like, we need to get other guys involved. Like, you know, Cole Swider is still not hitting field goals well, but he's hitting at the free throw line, and the whole team's really hitting well from the free throw line because we largely trot out a bunch of shooters the entire game. I think that there's got to be some different lineup permutations. I know you and I talked about this, you know, when the season started and before it even, and the week since. Like, it seemed like there were going to be a bunch of different lineup permutations, and it's just surprising how quickly we don't have any permutations anymore. And it's just like, let's go back to what we've been doing for the last 4 years, which is just let's run everybody and have and rack up minutes for our top players, in a fashion that no other program does. I think that's a, I don't think it's a great way to attract talent long term. I understand I'm not a Hall of Fame coach. I'm not even doubting what Jim's doing right now. I'm more just saying, like, I don't think we fare well here as a long term strategy of just, you know, playing five guys 40 minutes.
Yeah, and it's tough because, like, we hit this really tough stretch where obviously VCU, you know, was what it was, but, you know, they're not a pushover. They played UConn tough too. Auburn was brutal for us. And then Indiana, I think Jim really wanted to win that game. I don't really blame him for coaching to win that game explicitly. It's tough that we now have Florida State and Villanova back-to-back. Not the run that we, you know, usually are accustomed to getting guys ready. We really didn't have very much of a you know, warm-up. We had two pretty easy games, and then Colgate, which we got blindsided in. So hopefully in those Lehigh and Cornell games later this month, when we get past the Florida State, Villanova, Georgetown stretch, unless Georgetown's a walkover, which even when they're bad, they never are. They always play us tough. Hopefully we can kind of bounce back and get something going in terms of, like, allowing those guys to get some time. And then even the ACC, I think we just need to find some spots. Hopefully we play well in some of these games out the gate and we can get guys minutes. But, time is running out to, like, kind of have that development time that you would hope. And I just hope that we don't just collapse back into, like, a 5.5-man rotation at this point.
Yeah, it's not ideal. I'm definitely at least a little concerned. And having to shoot, you know, 34 threes. I mean, I guess, fine, you hit 13 of them. But still, like, it's 38% is passable, potentially. But it's not going to work every single time. I think getting to the line the way they did is really what won that game. And I think they have to find a way to strike the balance shooting-wise. But they'll get there. I think it's still early. We knew that the beginning of the season might be a little bit tougher than normal because there's so little continuity year to year. But I'm hopeful that things start coming together. Dan, you mentioned some of the tough games coming up. Before our next episode, we got two of those. At Florida State on Saturday and Villanova on Tuesday. Do you think that Syracuse has any shot to win either of those games?
They could beat Florida State. I don't think Florida State's great this year. They had a tough one against Tulane. They had a tough one with Boston U. They got blown out by Purdue. You know, Florida State's always pretty good, but this Florida State team looks pretty susceptible. Florida beat them pretty handily earlier in the year. So, I mean, they're not having, like, an appreciably better start than we are, to be honest. So I guess that one's definitely the more reasonable. Beating Villanova would really, like, kind of, hey, I wouldn't know what to think. Like, I wouldn't know how we got to where we are if we beat Villanova. I hope we look competitive, more competitive than we did against Auburn. So, yeah, it's really hard to project, but I don't feel overly confident. But I think Florida State, I certainly wouldn't write off at this point.
Yeah, I mean, Florida State, 32nd in KenPom, they're 40th on offense, 32nd on defense. In terms of efficiency, Nova, meanwhile, is 6th, according to KenPom, 3rd on offense, 48th on defense. Definitely not an ideal situation for us by any means. I know this would be, at least according to current KenPom ratings, Florida State and Villanova will mark the 3rd and 4th top 40 teams we faced already.
Yeah, we don't need to hear anything about our schedule this year. Like, people, I don't know if we've had, like, the Gottlieb tweets or whatever. Everyone needs to be quiet.
I mean, granted, I think until Pitt and BC decide to start playing basketball again, and look away from last year's scores when I say that. Pitt's ranked 200th in KenPom this year. BC is hanging around the, 130 mark. So, yeah, ideally, you know, if those programs that we face twice a year every year were better if the ACC improved to like even 80% of what it normally has been in the last 10 years before like 2 years ago, if that makes sense. I think we don't need to schedule as tough necessarily, but the current, this current state of things in the ACC and the current state of things with our, you know, twice a year permanent opponents force us to schedule a little bit tougher now, in this non-conference slate.
Yeah. I mean, the ACC, who knows what's going on? Right now, obviously the Big Ten is really late into, I think Syracuse is the first ACC win in this year's challenge. So that's not great. But and it's certainly probably not great for like the net rating type situation. But at the same time, the Syracuse team might just need to like get some confidence and get some easy wins. Like, I think the fact they haven't really been as well baked into the non-conference schedule might be of Syracuse's benefit to play like a slightly easier schedule and hope that it just kind of works out for the NCAA tournament. Because, like, you know, if we were just going to play the murderer's row of ACC teams that from a couple years ago, I don't know that we'd have much of a shot. Maybe we can actually like kind of develop something. If we can face like, you know, a down Wake team, a down Miami team, Pitt is terrible twice. BC's not very good. We have Wake twice too, I think. And like, I don't expect them to be great until the end of the year when things kind of ramp up again. So, you know, hopefully that is, you know, to Syracuse's advantage this year, but it's going to be tough, kind of tough to know until we get into it.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, ultimately, like, you do need to score a big win here and there, and we'll see if Indiana turns into one. We'll see if we can, you know, get one against Florida State here, but ultimately, like, you know, getting something on the road here against FSU would be nice. I'm not predicting it, but in general, I'd like to see SU be able to put together a few wins, because when you have six, like you said, six wins against Pitt, Wake, and BC potentially, like, it's not that those don't count for anything, but you do need to figure out the rest of the resume.
As we well know, if it comes down to where we're looking like we're on the bubble, like, those will be prodded into very, very heavily. So we need to get one or two of the big ones too. And, you know, we all know how this works now. Like, we've been through it so many times. But yeah, I really, outside of Duke, which looks really good, even though they lost to Ohio State last night, it's really tough to know with the ACC. I think they are the only ranked team in the league right now. I think they are, which is crazy.
Kind of horrifying in a lot of ways. Yeah, I mean, I'm not looking at the top 25. I'm just looking at the KenPom ratings and
Duke. I'm on the Google. Yeah, I'm on the Google calendar, and like, Dukes are only the only ACC ranked opponent. Else, I'm missing someone.
Delightful. Yeah, Duke's 7, FSU's 32, Notre Dame's 42, UNC's 49, Virginia Tech's 26. So they're close, at least KenPom wise. But yeah, Virginia's 47. This isn't great.
Yeah, I mean, nothing we can do about it. It's like, just set a hope Syracuse and just play up there.
And now we got more money because thank you, good people at Comcast.
Yes, that was good news this week.
That was good news.
All of our Philly brethren can finally watch the games. Since we're on ACC Network all the time, although I feel like most of them in RSNs, which I think is also a problem for them. So, yeah, good. That was actually like legitimately good news, and people in the Syracuse area too, I think, were affected by that. So,
yeah. Comcast is pretty big carrier.
Yeah. So, you know, happy for everyone who was previously unable to watch like a huge swath of Syracuse teams. Get that ACC Network. Go Packer and Durham and everything else.
All right, Dan, anything else before we depart today?
No. Interested to see how these Nets 2 play out. You know, hopefully they surprise us and use this Indiana game as a springboard. But otherwise, excited to get into the meat of the schedule here and forget about football for a little bit. I mean, signing day will be coming up, or the signing period will be coming up. And also, like, hope springs eternal when those football hires will be made. We'll talk ourselves into them, and everyone will look great. So I'm looking forward to that.
Agreed. Well, on that note, that was Dan. I'm John. Thank you, everybody, for listening to Trying Games and Absolute Podcast. You rate, review, subscribe on iTunes, Megaphone, TuneIn, Stitcher, Overcast, wherever you listen to podcasts, and go Orange.
Go Orange.